Welcome into another edition of the Dana Victory Podcast, only on MusketeerReport.com. I'm Rick. He's Dan. And it's been a little while since I've talked to you, Dan. How are you doing?
I'm well. You know, there's been a lot of good news in the Cincinnati sports scene over the last couple weeks, Rick. Some of it we talked about at the Wofford game, the Bengals beating – well, actually, this happened just last weekend, but the Bengals beating Pittsburgh away, finally getting that gorilla off their back, make the playoffs. And the Reds made a nice trade to upgrade their center field situation. There was all the excitement about Reds Fest and everything like that. And then, of course, the conference realignment continues to spin. And if you're a casual follower even of UC football, you have the whole Tuberville thing. So there's a lot of things in Cincinnati sports that are, you know, interesting and uplifting and everything else. And I guess we're going to talk about none of them tonight. Obviously, this was a tough week for the Musketeers. So we're not going to sugarcoat it too much tonight. Xavier lost two games in the past week. They lost a crosstown shootout last Wednesday by a final of 60-45 to the University of Cincinnati. They came back on Saturday, blew a 12-point halftime lead in a loss to Wofford. The final of that one was 56-55 in favor of the Terriers. Muskies fall to 7-4. But I wanted to, but before we get into those two games, Rick, I wanted to talk briefly about the really nice tribute that the Xavier basketball team did before the Wofford game. As I'm sure everybody in America is aware of the tragic violence at the elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut, I suppose almost 2 weeks ago. And the Musketeers trying to do their part to pay tribute and also to raise some money for that cause. And I was wondering if you could give some background on how that came together, and maybe we can talk about that as a lead-in to this week's games.
Yeah, well, you mentioned that they had special jerseys that were basically the way it came about, according to Mike Babinski, when we talked about the game, was it really wasn't anything that had to do with Xavier's athletic department or anything like that. That just came from Mario Mercurio, who is the director of operations at Xavier, and he was dealing with Nike, and they came up with the idea and, you know, thought obviously it would be a good tribute, and if nothing else, just a way to show the people in Newtown that they're thinking of him in Cincinnati, that, you know, Xavier bleeds for him, as Coach Mack put it. And I thought it was really well done. And the cool thing was that, you know, they went all out. I mean, it wasn't just rinky-dink uniforms. It was very legitimate, cool-looking Nike uniforms and team shoes that were green and gray that the team practiced in the day before the game. I thought it was well executed by everyone. It was just something that was forever present during the game. I mean, a lot of times you see a little tribute before a game or something where it's kind of just half-assed and everyone forgets about it as soon as the game starts. But this was something that was unobtrusive. It didn't interrupt the game. It wasn't goofy or awkward at mid-court or anything before the game started. It was just something almost subtle, but at the same time you saw it the whole game and kind of reminded you of. I thought it was really well done by all parties.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And for those that aren't aware, I think the auctions are still going on. All the jerseys from that game, the game-worn jerseys, are being auctioned off on GoXavier.com. I believe that all the proceeds from those auctions are going to go to the relief efforts for the families who lost children or adults, you know, administrators and so forth in that horrible tragedy. So I would encourage everybody to check that out. And even I took a look at the auction site today, and the prices are pretty well through the roof, which is a great showing. I mean, Xavier's going to raise a lot of money, be able to write a pretty nice check to those organizations. But even if you don't have the money to drop hundreds of dollars on a game-worn jersey like that, I would encourage people to look into whether it be that or whether it be the volunteer firefighters who were killed in New York on Christmas Eve. There's been so many of these horrible acts that have been perpetrated around the holidays, and it'd be nice, you know, it's nice when people can reach out outside that community. But yeah, so there's no easy way to turn from that discussion into basketball. So Rick, let's talk first, I guess, about the UC game. You did a quick post-game podcast with Paul Daner, who writes for the UC athletic department website. Maybe you can, I don't know that all our listeners would have caught that. Why don't you just give us your basic rundown of that game and we'll see where we go from there.
Yeah, and Paul and I really didn't talk about the game as much as far as what happened on the court, but more so just moving the game to US Bank Arena, what the atmosphere was like, what we thought of it, and what's going on going forward. And both of us kind of agreed that it actually was a cooler atmosphere than I think anyone expected. US Bank Arena is still a dump, and both sides don't look like they're going to budge on what they want, which is Xavier wants it to go back to the campuses, and UC wants it to stay at US Bank Arena or maybe possibly cancel it altogether. So anyway, that was basically what Paul and I talked about. As for the game itself, I don't want to get into this one too much because I think end of the day, this is kind of what we expected. We kind of knew that this was going to happen when these two teams met up. UC has its issues. It's not perfect, as we saw just the other night when they lost. But at the same time, they were ranked as highly as they were for a reason. They are a solid team. They really defend well. And they have an ability to go on runs that has kind of made their season so far this year. And obviously the other night they didn't have that when they lost. But against Xavier, you saw that at the beginning of the second half, they went on a run that just basically ended the game. And I think you made the comment that you had never seen a two-point game or one-possession game go to a lost cause so quickly. And that's exactly what this UC team does to a lot of teams. So I'm not so much looking at it from a perspective of Xavier was awful and there's so much to take away from this. I thought it was the game played out kind of as I expected it to be honest. I thought the first half, everything went as well as could possibly have been expected for this Xavier team. Yes, they struggled to score, but that's this Xavier team's MO. And, you know, after that run, they really just, like you said, it went to pretty much a lost cause. That was the end of the game.
Yeah, I mean, it was about a three-minute period where it felt like Xavier couldn't get the ball over midcourt. And a lot of that, and let's talk about that briefly, because I'm not going to say blame, but a lot of the reasons given for this loss stemmed from the point guard play. And there were two different issues. One was the fact that Samaje Christen was limited to only 23 minutes because, once again, we saw that cramping issue crop up in the second half, and he was on the bench for a portion of that major run. They tried to bring him back to help sort of stanch the wound after that, but it didn't really work, and he was still in pain, and he couldn't play anymore. D. Davis, who was left out there, he just had – there's no way to sugarcoat it. He had about as nightmarish a three-minute stretch. He may not have been bad all told for the game, but he had about as nightmarish a three-minute stretch of point guard play as it's possible to have. So those two guys kind of had this loss laid at their feet, but – I guess the first question is, what do you know about the issues with Samaje and D, and did you feel like they made strides to improve that in the Wofford game, and do you expect that what we saw in the UC game is going to be the rule or the exception going forward?
Are you talking about their cramping and the physical problems they had, or just the problems they had with UC's press?
I think it's more, well, with Samaje, it's the cramping issue. And then he wasn't overly effective against Wofford either, which we'll get to later. But with D, with the problems he had against the press, I mean, that's more what I'm asking is did UC create a blueprint that's going to give Xavier problems as they get into league play with the way that the guards really struggled to execute against that trap?
No, I don't think UC created a blueprint. I think, one, very few teams can defend the way UC can. And that's part of what made that run so nightmarish, as you put it. It was going to be a bad run anyway. Xavier obviously had issues, and they had Samaje out of the game, and D struggled. But UC's defense was a big reason for that. I mean, and they made it worse than it probably would have been. The other thing in regards to D, I didn't really think – I mean, I agree. D had his mistakes. There's no way around that. I mean, he had two turnovers, I believe, in that little period you're talking about, and one of them was really bad. He had a couple defensive plays, too, where it's like he made the turnover or the team turned it over or whatever, and he kind of just gave up on the play. It was a bad few minutes for D. But as far as what they did to him defensively in the backcourt – really, it was a lack of help. I mean, D just didn't have anyone else to go to. Guys were running away from the ball like it was a JV game and they didn't want to touch it against a press. I mean, it was a bad stretch for Xavier. I don't think it can all be put on D. Davis. And I think D. Davis ended up looking really poorly because he was the one with the ball in his hands. But at the end of the day, there were a lot of guys who were not stepping up during those moments.
Yeah, I mean, there were portions of that stretch where UC would bring the second man to attack the point guard in the backcourt. And the other four players for Xavier, it looked like they were running the old Dean Smith four corners. It seemed like everybody was almost hiding from the ball. A few possessions in, Isaiah Fillmore kind of, I guess the light bulb went on or the coaches got him on the right stretch, and Fillmore started moving to the center of the floor, providing a little bit of help to the point guard, and they stopped hemorrhaging and turning the ball over at that point. And even when Redford had to run the point after D left with his cramps, they weren't as bad with turning the ball over, although obviously when you have Redford running the point and as poor as most of the big men were, it was going to be a long second half. In another issue that popped up in the UC game that was disturbing was foul shooting. The Musketeers shot 3 of 14 from the line in that game. Against Wofford, they were a little bit better, but not much, only 8 of 16. Any explanation for this situation, or are we seeing the whole team in a slump all at once, or are these guys just bad foul shooters?
I actually am not that worried about the foul shooting thing, especially for the whole team. I don't think they're bad free throw shooters. I think they'll be all right in the long run. When you just look at the individuals, I mean, I think D. Davis will be fine from the free throw line. Isaiah Fillmore is a good foul shooter. Travis Taylor has struggled in the past, but honestly, I think he's gotten over those problems, and he hasn't really been that bad so far this year. I mean, he's shooting almost 70% from the line, which, you know, isn't terrible. So I think the biggest thing right now with the free throw is Samaje, and that's clearly a head issue. I mean, Samaje is a free, he's okay from the free throw line. Someone asked the question, has that been a problem in his career coming up? And, you know, I thought about it for a while, and I was like, honestly, I kind of remember him being a good free throw shooter, and maybe it wasn't that he was a great free throw shooter, but it certainly wasn't a problem from what I remember covering him. And I watched him a ton, both in high school and on his AAU team, and that wasn't a problem. So this is clearly mental. I mean, he missed 5 in a row in the closing minutes of that Wofford game that really killed Xavier. And the problem, the reason it looks even worse than just him missing, a freshman missing a few free throws, is that he's one of the few guys on this team that can draw contact, can do what Tu Holloway did in late game situations last year, you know, get to the free throw line when Xavier needs points and they're struggling to score, which this team does pretty frequently. He's the one guy that can get there almost at will and get to the free throw line. But when you can't make the free throws, it's a problem. And that's what we've seen, is he's had these opportunities at the end of games to either put the game on ice or bring Xavier back in, and he can't knock him down. And it's just a mental thing. It's a mental block. He'll get over it at some point. It's just, how long does it last?
So let's move on with that transition into the Wofford game, as little as probably anyone wants to relive it. Final score, 56-55. A wild finish, which we'll get into later. But, you know, traditionally we've seen Xavier struggle with a post-shootout hangover in the past. This would hardly be the first time that X has come back from a crosstown shootout, win or loss, and immediately played a very subpar game in the immediate aftermath. The coaching staff has tried to, I think, negate that somewhat by usually leaving some days off in between the shootout and the next game, or trying to schedule one of the softer teams on the schedule, which probably was the design of this Wofford game. But for 20 minutes, it looked like the Musketeers had pretty well put the crosstown shootout behind them. They played pretty well in the first half. I thought they shot 58.3% from the field. Even though they weren't hitting threes, they were getting the ball inside. Travis Taylor had a huge first half. He almost secured a double-double before halftime. D. Davis played well. Samaje was getting his. I thought going into halftime that it looked like the Musketeers had basically put things behind them. But as we've seen on more than one occasion this year, they couldn't come out in the second half with the same level of intensity. What did you see happening at the beginning of the second half that let Wofford back into that basketball game?
Well, the biggest thing was that Wofford changed what they were doing defensively, and every time Travis Taylor touched the ball, they were double-teaming him and making him give it up. Now, I know to some that might sound shocking, but of course, if you remember back to the first half of this game, Travis Taylor had absolutely dominated the first half and scored at will, which really helped Xavier's offense. I mean, they really haven't had that this year where they've been able to throw it into a big guy with his back to the basket, and he's been able to give them points almost every time they throw it in. I think he was like 6 of 7 or something from the field. He was dominating inside. When Wofford took that away, all of a sudden, Xavier needed something else. Now, for the most of the year, that's been Samaje. And whether it be scoring points in transition, getting to the rim, making tough shots, that's been Samaje. We finally saw what happened when Samaje can't seem to get it going offensively, and the rest of the team is looking around like, what do we do now? Travis Taylor was that guy in the first half that allowed him to get over that hump, but in the second half when Wofford took him away, no one else was able to step up, and Samaje had his first real freshman game of the year where he just struggled. He couldn't find a rhythm. He missed some shots. He couldn't make anything from the free throw line, and it wasn't a terrible game for him, but he wasn't the leading scorer and bucket getter that we've seen most of the year.
Yeah, and this again was one of those games where in the first half it felt like X absolutely could not maintain a rhythm on offense for more than a couple possessions at a time. Now, they did a pretty good job. They were ahead 34-22 at halftime. That obviously shows that they were playing good defense and that they were controlling the tempo of the game. But again, when you see this team succeed offensively, what you're seeing when they go on runs, quote unquote, they're 3 minutes long and they outscore the other team 8-2 or something like that. Right. It's not like what we saw where UC puts up 8 points in 90 seconds and all of a sudden turns a game from a competitive enterprise to one where they're comfortably ahead. And part of that, unfortunately, is the fact that the team just cannot put the ball in the basket right now. The second half against Wofford, the Musketeers were 8 of 22 for 36%. Wofford, frankly, wasn't much better. That was probably the stretch maybe between about the 12-minute mark and the 4-minute mark of that game, Rick, was just about the ugliest stretch of basketball I've seen in a long, long time.
And really the stretch right before that, too, it was about a 4 or 5 minute stretch from maybe 18 to 13 or so was just that's when Wofford made their big 16-4 run, I believe, and kind of iced the game, or not iced the game, but got back into the game and put Xavier in a dogfight. And everything went bad for Xavier during that stretch. You look at that second half, Wofford shot just 34.6%. Which was worse than what they shot in the first half when Xavier was beating them by 12 at halftime. So you look at the second half, and the problem is clearly offensively for this team. But I also think, you know, we've talked about in the past, when they struggle offensively, they tend to tie their defensive effort to that. And we probably saw that for that 3 or 4 minute stretch that I talked about there, where they just had, you just sort of see a letdown on that end of the court. I mean, whether it be guys lose focus, guys lose intensity, or guys just aren't tough enough or aren't physical enough. They gave up some easy buckets when Wofford needed them that helped extend their run. So now instead of Wofford having a 10-2 run or an 8-2 run, they've got a 16-4 run, and it's a big problem for Xavier. And I think that's the biggest difference is Xavier can't – we've talked about it so much this year that I think I've said many times that this team is good enough to play with almost anyone, but they're not good enough to pull away from anyone because offensively they just don't have that type of firepower, and you saw it again in this game. I mean, they couldn't make that big run. They let Wofford get back into it, but what they've got to do is they've got to limit the runs by other teams. Wofford isn't a team that can go on a 16-4 run, Xavier. UC, that's one thing. UC's good enough to do that. Wofford can't do it. That's when Xavier's going to lose games like this. But when you look at Wofford as far as how tough of a game that was, I don't think they were any different from teams like Robert Morris, Drexel, Vanderbilt that we've seen already this year that Xavier's had trouble with. I think they were right in that same sort of grouping of those second-tier teams that Xavier's played on their schedule this year that have given them some trouble.
Well, and I think from a positive perspective, I guess let's start with what the positives were from this week from individual analyses, and then we'll talk about the end of the Wofford game just because it was so bizarre. Travis Taylor had a great week. You know, he scored 32 points between the two games. He, especially against Wofford, was commanding in the post in that first half, which was about the best, which is about the best we've seen him play, I think, in a Xavier uniform those 20 minutes. Unfortunately, though, none of the other big men produced in a way that Xavier needs them to produce to be successful in these games. Justin Martin got into early foul trouble against UC. He ended up laying a goose egg as far as scoring goes in 16 minutes. Against Wofford, he didn't get into ruinous foul trouble early, but he never got into the game. He was 2 for 8 from the field, missed all 3 of his 3-point attempts, and only got 2 rebounds in that game. So if you add those two games together, you're looking at 37 minutes for Justin and just 4 points and 4 rebounds. Isaiah Fillmore as well, I never seemed to get off the schneid in either game. He had an early basket against UC, I know, but again, his lack of lift against those UC big men made him a constant target, it felt like. And UC doesn't have particularly skilled big men, but they seemed to be able to push him around a little bit. And UC was just dominant as far as the offensive glass went in that game.
Well,
against Wofford,
I did think in the second half, though, I did think Fillmore was actually the one bright spot in the second half of that UC game. I think he scored all of his points, 8 of his points in that second half when Xavier was really struggling and they needed someone. I thought he came up and finally showed a little something in that second half for a few minutes there against UC, but overall I agree with you.
And then the last one, which will take us into the discussion at the end of the Wofford game, was Jeff Robinson, who continues to just be an enigmatic performer. Well, let's talk about the end of the Wofford game. You and I talked about it as we were sitting there at the scores table afterwards. I don't think I've ever seen a game like that in my life as far as, you know, the comeback that Xavier almost executed in the last 30 seconds of that game, only to have it dashed by a play that was just so elementary and so out of nowhere. and not only once, but twice, in fact. That had to be a devastating loss for the guys on the team, just the circumstances that they went through, given a chance to push it to overtime with 7 seconds left and having that taken away by a mistake, and then having a chance to win the game in the last seconds and having that taken away by a 50-50 call. I mean, it must have been a heck of a thing for those guys to sort of come to terms with in the days afterwards.
Yeah, this game could have very easily been looked at the same way that Robert Morris game was earlier in the year. Or, you know, the Drexel, the Drake, the Kent State games. I mean, all these games against, I guess average teams to below average teams, you would say, have been fairly close for Xavier this year. And this was almost another one of the same things. They almost just overcame a bad stretch in the second half. Redford gets them back in the game with those miraculous 2 threes at desperation time. Maybe not fair. We might be a little biased in this sense, but it felt like Xavier was. If that game goes into overtime, you had the feeling that Xavier had the momentum and likely comes out on top. And then, I mean, after Redford hits that second three to tie it up, basically what had happened was they had talked about it in the timeout right before the second three that did tie it up, that they would look for 2 if it was open and then foul still. They felt they had enough time to do that. But there was an option in the play. Obviously, one was Samaje getting to the rim. The other was Redford shooting the 3. Samaje did a great job of drawing Redford's man off of him, and not only off of him, but to the inside of Samaje. So he was basically able to just do a little dribble handoff pitch type deal and pick Redford's man as he was dribbling past. Left Redford wide open, and he knocked it down to tie the game up. But for whatever reason, Jeff Robinson, it never registered with him that the game was now tied.
Going back to that, I thought that both the plays that were drawn up, because they were both obviously drawn up from the sideline and they had multiple options, but I thought that the design and execution of both the set plays that got Redford, those looks in the last 20 seconds were outstanding.
Yeah, I did too. And the first one was a really tough shot by Brad. I mean, he had guys right on him. He had to pull it almost as soon as it touched his hands. It barely even looked like he had time to actually catch the ball.
And in fact, that was with X down four. It was actually very similar to the shot he hit at the end of overtime against Vandy to get it back to a one-point deficit. And the Xavier bench, and I think a lot of the guys on the court thought that Brad was fouled on the play. And
I did too.
It would have been a legit call. Let's just say that, because we had seen on the same, not on the same end of the court, but in front of the bench on the other side, we had seen, I think, three times in that game, Xavier players called for following through on 3-point shooters by Wofford, which was part of the problem that X had in the game.
Right.
Was giving the Terriers easy points, but I you know, you got to take your hat off to the coaches for the way they handled that end game situation, because it's not easy, and they were also walking a tightrope, especially on that last possession, because Wofford could have fouled and then put X in a situation where they had to miss a free throw on purpose, and so it's important to have a play that develops quickly and doesn't give the defense time to think about what they want to do to get a shot like that. And the execution of it was phenomenal. But of course we saw that issue, and you and I talked after the game. The only thing that I think there are two similar plays that I can think of. One was, I want to say it was Ashton Gibbs, but I'm sure it wasn't him, for Pitt fouling Matt Howard on a free throw, with Pittsburgh leading by a point or two or in a tie game late during one of Butler's national championship game runs. And then also, I seem to remember a kid from Memphis fouling a UAB player from behind in a tie game a couple years ago in a similar situation, 80 feet from the hoop. But it was just such a bizarre situation. And it was also one of those things where you just felt like the roof was caving in at that point, because it had to be Jeff Robinson, right? It couldn't be any other guy on the team. It couldn't be one of the guys that's been a contributor, that's been a consistent contributor, makes a mistake, and everybody's just like, okay, it's got to be Jeff Robinson, who's the kid that showed so much promise at the beginning of the year, has had all this physical ability his whole career, and has just never put it together. It seemed just like almost Shakespearean the way it happened. But Wofford goes down. They make one free throw to give him a 1-point lead, miss the second, and then Samaje got a nice chance to win the game. And what happened? I mean, we obviously were sitting right next to each other, but as you watch that play develop, what did you see? Did you think the call was correctly made? Did it make a difference ultimately, given the way Samaje was shooting foul shots? What was sort of your thoughts as you saw that?
I felt that it was a bad call. I thought it was a block. They called the charge on Samaje. I thought it was a block. And Coach Mack was really mad. I know a couple people tweeted after the game, you know, what set Coach Mack off in the handshake line? Well, he had turned around to yell at an official, basically, and a couple of the other coaches sort of pulled him back at that point. He was really hot over the call. It's always tough. The charge block is as tough a call as there is in sports, with maybe the exception of pass interference. Those are right there with each other. But the charge and block is just so difficult to call as an official. And then they've made the rule to where there's more to look for, and it's even more confusing than it's ever been, in my opinion. So it's really tough to rely and say, oh, that changed the game right there. Because if you're relying on a charge block call, it's probably your own fault. You factor in the fact that Samaje was 0 for 5 at the line and just mentally didn't seem like he had a chance of hitting a free throw when he went up there. And it probably really doesn't make a difference. But at the same time, when you're talking about the last possession of the game, a very questionable charge call that would have sent Xavier's best player to the free throw line down by one. I'm sure for Xavier fans, that's tough to swallow, because in my opinion, it was a bad call.
So let's talk two bigger picture things. These two basketball games, Xavier was outscored 72-42 in the second half, if you add up the aggregate scores of the Wofford and UC second halves. And earlier this year, we saw X blow a 13-point lead in the second half against Vanderbilt. We saw them see a pretty comfortable 15-point lead, I think, against Kent State, reduced to 5 before they pulled away at the end. I think Robert Morris, they had that game at 8 or 9 points for most of the second half and saw it slip away. What do you think is contributing to X's struggles, especially coming right out of the locker room in second halves of basketball games?
Well, I think that it's tough to pin it on one thing. I think there's several things. And, you know, one has been their struggles from the free throw line. You see that a lot of times more later in the game. I mean, teams are fouling for a reason, you know, try to get back into the game, or they've got to turn it up defensively a little bit. They start fouling a little more. Well, you miss free throws, and it allows teams to get back in the game. That's a small part of it. I also think just having a younger team, when you get into crunch time, when the other team, you play some of these teams with some upperclassmen and they're starting to make their run like every team does in college basketball. I mean, it's a game of runs. It's going to happen. There's nothing you can really do about it. You've just got to weather those storms. When those runs happen against Xavier, they're a team without a lot of leadership, without go-to scores on the offensive end. They struggle during those times because they don't have a lot of people willing to step up or ready to step up or capable of stepping up other than maybe Samaje Kristen, who is a freshman. And that's just the problem of having a freshman as your best player, especially when you don't have much offensive talent around him. And to me, those are the biggest problems that this team's seen. The other thing is that they've just got to grow up a little bit. I mean, they come out and they're a little lackadaisical. Who knows? Maybe they haven't loosened themselves up properly after sitting for halftime. The cramps thing has been a huge issue for Xavier in the second half when Samaje's had to leave the game. I think there's a lot of different factors. You can't pin it on one, but most of it comes back to the fact that this team is young, they're challenged offensively, and there's some pretty good basketball players playing for other schools as well.
Well, and it actually reminded me of something that I was reading over the last holiday weekend. I was reading an old up at my parents, an old John Feinstein book about the NFL, and he talks about Brian Billick trying to get his Ravens teams in the mid-2000s to avoid something he called stacking, which is where it's a psychological thing where basically you wake up and, you know, the floor is cold in your bathroom, or you don't get enough hot water in your shower, so you're pissed off about that. Then you go get in the car, and then somebody cuts you off in traffic. And instead of those two things being discrete things, they add on to each other, right? And then you get to work, and somebody makes you mad. And so all this stress builds up and builds up and builds up. And that's the way I almost feel watching X when they come out in the second half, because they have – because they'll miss foul shots, and that leads to empty possessions, and then they'll have a turnover or two, and then you just start feeling that ball rolling downhill, and it's tough to stop it, and it's really tough to stop it when you have a team that just doesn't have enough, to me, consistent scorers and guys that can put the ball in the basket when they get to the foul line. And I think it's going to be a problem for Xavier until they see somebody besides Samaje Kristen step up that can score the ball consistently. And we thought that we might have had that at the very beginning of the season with Robinson. That's obviously not the case. Then we thought that we might have that in Justin Martin with the way he started the season, but he's sort of fallen off the map the last few games. So who's it going to be at the end of the day? So that, I think, is one pretty big issue. Rick, at this stage, I guess we can talk about Jeff Robinson, although at this stage, it's just he's just so enigmatic. It's hard to tell what the team can do about him. There's been a lot of calls I see on both the scout message board and some of the free boards about, well, let's just not play him anymore. Let's give James Fry his minutes. Let's give James Farr his minutes. I'm sorry. Let's give Stenger some more playing time. Do you think any of those are actual possibilities, or is Xavier just going to have to work with Jeff Robinson and hope he gets it as the season progresses?
Well, I think, for one, you've already started to see both Fillmore and Stenger take back some of those minutes. I mean, Stenger has played more minutes the last couple games than he's seen over that probably the previous 5 or 6 game stretch. I mean, he played decent minutes at the beginning of the year, I remember, in the first couple of games, but it really tailed off there for a while. It's starting to pick back up now, and the exact reason for that is simply the play of Jeff Robinson, and he just has not been reliable at all. At this point, without trying to diagnose what Jeff Robinson's problem is, without making, you know, attacks on him or anything like that. Looking at it from a perspective of what the staff needs to do, it's time. You can't rely on him, obviously. I mean, it's time to quit saying, oh, maybe he's going to step up, or if we can get Jeff to do this, or if Jeff can do that for us. You don't worry about that anymore. But at the same time, Chris Mack's trying to win ball games. He's got a job. He gets paid a lot of money to do that job. He's not trying to lose that job. So he's not going to put James Farr in there right now. And I know a lot of people look at it as like, well, this guy was supposed to be good, and he was rated this or that. And in James' case, that's not really true because he was under the radar. But just with freshmen in general, everybody wants them to be who they are as soon as they get on campus. And it's so tough, I guess, for people to remember just going back a couple years, or really any year for that matter. A lot of Xavier prospects, or a lot of Xavier's best players, didn't come in and dominate right away as freshmen, or weren't even great players as freshmen or sophomores. It took them time to develop, and that's almost always the case with big men especially. James is in the same situation. He's just not as good as Jeff or Stanger, who are the guys playing ahead of him right now, basically. He's obviously not going to play over Taylor or Fillmore, and he's not as good as the other two. He's not physically near as strong as Stanger, and obviously he's not much bigger or more athletic than Jeff. So he just doesn't really give you anything else. He's got a lot of things he needs to work on in terms of getting a little bit stronger physically, but also just learning how to use his body. He's so stiff, like we've talked about in the past. He plays very straight up, which, because he plays so straight up, he doesn't understand how to use leverage in the post and gain position. He gets pushed off the block way too easily. He has a lot of things he needs to work on. He's improving every day. He's getting better. He's understanding the system, but I don't think you're going to see James Farr play a bunch more minutes here. Maybe by the end of the season, especially if things go poorly in the conference play, maybe you'll see him pick up 5 to 10 minutes a game at the most, but I highly doubt that. I don't expect to be James to be much of an impact player this season at all.
Going back to the Wofford endgame, there was another thing that was posted that I think is a legitimate question, which is that given Robinson's tendency to make stupid mistakes, why was he in the game?
Well, I'm trying to think at that situation who all was on the court and who could have been on in his place. I mean, are we talking about putting Eric Stanger in his place? Because I don't want to do that at all. I mean, if Eric Stanger has to touch the ball in offense in that situation, you've got a major problem.
Now Stanger did have a very pretty 40-foot left-handed floater at the end of the first half, you may recall.
Yes, you're right.
I mean, it hit the blue blob, but
Other than him shooting the ball, I don't want him touching it on offense. I mean, in late-game situations, putting the ball in Eric Stanger's hand, one, and asking him to make decisions, and two, just asking him to have any skill is not what you want to do. So if that was the other option to play Stanger, then no, I don't think Jeff should have been off of the court. I'm just trying to think what the situation was and who would have been in there. I mean, Landon Amos wouldn't have been a better option. So, and he might have been in at that time anyway. So everyone wanted Jeff out of the game, but my question is always, well, who do you put in? You don't want James Farr in that situation. He's a freshman. I mean, you had to play both sides of the ball, too. It wasn't like they called a timeout
right
to make a defensive substitution.
Well, and that's the other thing that's important to remember, is that both teams were out of timeouts at that point. And when X reconfigured its lineup to rebound Wofford's free throws, they had to consider that those guys were going to be on the floor for the remainder of the game. And maybe the thought was, the thought was that Robinson gives you a chance at a stick back, potentially. Sure. A stick back and a three-point play. He's also a relatively good foul shooter compared to some of the other guys on the floor. So, I mean, I can understand why he's on the floor. I don't think it's quite as cut and dry as just – I mean, it's easy to say with hindsight, well, Robinson, you know, made an unbelievably stupid mistake. He shouldn't have been on the floor. I don't understand why he's on the floor. I think that it's a lot more – scenario driven, maybe, and the decision was probably a lot more nuanced than what people are saying.
And that's us just looking at it from a perspective of saying after he made the mistake, he shouldn't have been on the floor. I mean, before he made that mistake, there was never a chance in a million years that Chris Mack thought he was going to go and foul there after they hit a three to tie it up. I mean, that he's made some mistakes, but it certainly hasn't been mistakes like that where he just had no idea the situation of the game and cost them like that. I mean,
well, and
you just
part
can't
of the
predict
thing
that
is,
as a coach.
Yeah, a coach cannot legislate for his players doing things that boneheaded.
Right.
I mean, it's just impossible.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on to another issue, Rick, and this is one that I kind of have been saving for a podcast like this where we've got a little bit of time to consider this issue. But you've brought it up a couple times to me during games, which is, give me your theory on why opposing teams shoot so well at the Cintas Center.
I really don't know. And to be honest with you, if I would have known we were doing this, I should have looked. There's probably stats where I can see what opponents shoot against Xavier at home. I should have pulled that up to see if teams truly do shoot that well at Xavier, because I know a lot of games I go in and I say, man, this guy lit it up or that guy lit it up. And then when you really go back and look at the stats, I mean, the team shot just 36% or whatever the case may be. So I feel like we see a lot of teams shoot well from the outside at Xavier, but it's probably also a case where Xavier makes it tough to get into the lane and score around the basket defensively. That's what they try to do. So teams, especially, we often say this when it's a team like a Wofford or a smaller school that isn't supposed to be as good, comes in and hits a lot of threes. Well, part of it's probably because they don't have as good a post player, so they're attempting more threes, they're relying on the three, and they do have, there seems to be a lot more guards out there who can shoot the ball than there are big guys who can play well inside and great athletes. So that's probably part of it. But I do think when you just look at the Cintas Center, I do think it's a great place to shoot. I mean, it's a nice background, it's pretty even, it's got a pretty blank canvas as far as what you see when you're shooting at it. It's not too distant, not too far off like US Bank Arena, where you've just got basically endless space behind it, but you do have enough room to where there's not anything there distracting you. So maybe that's part of it. Maybe teams do like the shooting backdrop at the Cintas Center, but it seems like Xavier, and not just this year, but in the past couple of years, really struggled with some teams that aren't very good coming in and knocking down three balls that keep them in the game at the Cintas Center.
The other issue was brought up on the message board about the atmosphere against Wofford. Xavier has always had the reputation, I know Brian's brought it up a few times, that it's not a particularly intimidating home court advantage.
Right.
And I would tend to agree with that. Having grown up going to games at the Cincinnati Gardens, I remember those games at the Gardens being far more raucous than the way it is at Cintas, and maybe they're different things that we can discuss that play into that. I think the lighting is probably the number one issue. But, I mean, the Wofford game in particular was kind of a morgue. And I usually don't notice that, but I did notice it in that game until the last bit where people got very into the game. Do you think it's a matter of just sort of the fans are adopting a wait-and-see attitude with this team? Or is it just a situation where the Muskies, especially in the last four home games, are just playing, the games are close, but they're so almost boring that the fans aren't really getting into them. You know what I mean?
Well,
not boring in that the games aren't close and they're not tense, but that they're
ugly.
They
not
just
fun basketball.
Yeah. They'll go through four. I mean, against Wofford, there was a 5-minute stretch where neither team scored.
Yeah. It was certainly an ugly second half, and it wasn't fun to watch. I mean, we can vouch for that. We were sitting right there courtside. One of the things that has to be considered for the Wofford game, though, the students weren't on campus, right? They were all gone.
That's right.
So there
That's
was no
right.
student section. So when you here's the thing about Cintas. You've got a lot of people that make good money that sit in those lower sections. People who make a lot of money and, you know, tend to be older and upper class don't tend to go to games and act too crazy. That's just the way it is. So Xavier relies on the student section to be really good, which they didn't have against Wofford at all. There was no, I mean, it was empty for one, and the people that were sitting there were more people who probably bought the tickets off a student who were adults. So it really just wasn't the type of crowd that was going to get ruckus for one. But yeah, I do think this, even the Cintas crowd that is usually a little more loud than it has been in some of the games this year, and I do think it's because usually you feed off of your team scoring, your team knocking down shots and getting into a rhythm and getting on maybe a 14-0 run or something like we talked about earlier, and this team struggles to do that. Even their runs are 4 field goals spaced out over 3 or 4 minutes and maybe a couple free throws thrown in there. It's not a lot of up and down scoring or guys knocking down threes to get the crowd excited and really get some momentum and get them rolling that'll extend. I mean, they get up for a play or two, but then there's a lull of 3.5 minutes before they score again.
Right, right. Well, the Muskies back in action tomorrow, today, as you're listening to this. If we're recording this on Friday night, December the 28th, the Musketeers are in Knoxville, Tennessee, as we speak. They will play the Tennessee Volunteers tomorrow at 6 p.m., at Thompson Bowling Arena, which is right next to Neyland Stadium, actually. If you look over the top of Neyland Stadium, you can almost spit on it. UT this season is 7-3. They have played actually, I would say, a pretty good schedule. They their three losses are to Oklahoma State, Georgetown, and then Virginia. Virginia being probably the bad loss there. They also beat Wichita State in Knoxville, who's a AP top 25 team. I guess the biggest thing that you notice with UT is the fact that in games against good teams, and I would define those as being those three losses that we mentioned plus the Wichita State game, they've only scored over 50 points one time. They had a back-to-back stretch in late November and December where they lost to Georgetown on the road, mind you, 37-36, and then lost to Virginia and Charlottesville 46-38, and that's a game that I can only imagine was completely unwatchable. I wonder what the former Saints coach Jim Mora would have said about that. But the Vols come in riding a three-game winning streak. Most recently, they beat Western Carolina 66-52 last Friday. So they're coming off a long layoff as well. Well, what do you know about the Vols, Rick, and how do you see this game going for the Musketeers?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. They struggle to score. I have to imagine Xavier's staff has been watching this Tennessee team throughout the course of the year. I mean, you know, you've got to play a team coming up in your non-conference. You're watching how they do, maybe even if you don't usually. And this staff really kind of keeps up with college basketball a ton anyway. They're just so into it. they're probably watching this Tennessee team, hoping they keep winning games and do really well, and at the same time can't wait to play them. Because it's a team that, if Xavier has to play a good team, quote-unquote, or a team that has some name recognition, they'd much rather it be a team like Tennessee that can't score. And that Tennessee makes it ugly. They're physical. They play good defense. They guard the perimeter well, but they can't score. They're similar to Xavier in the fact that they really don't have like one go-to guy on the offensive end. They have guys who are capable of making plays. They have guys who are capable of getting offensive rebounds and scoring, like Jarnell Stokes inside. But they don't have guys that they can throw the ball to and say, get us 20 a game. They just don't have that type of player on their roster. And it also kind of makes it sort of spread out just as Xavier's scoring is, where they have, you know, several guys averaging close to double digits or just under, and you don't really know who to necessarily key on. That being said, their best player is, in my opinion, it's Jarnell Stokes, but junior guard Trey Golden is leading them in scoring. Jarnell Stokes is the one that worries me for Xavier the most, though, because he's 6'8", 280 pounds or so. He's tons of muscle. He's tons of athleticism. He's sort of like a Jamel McLean, except maybe even a little more explosive and skilled inside as far as how he can score. He's averaging about 12 a game right now and 8 rebounds, but you look at this Xavier team, the way they've struggled against bigger, more physically imposing, girthier, if you will, post players, you've really got to be worried about Jarnell Stokes inside.
Well, the odds makers certainly not giving the Musketeers a whole lot of credit. They have UT running out as a 9-point favorite in tomorrow evening's game. The total is 121, which is
by the way, I'm taking the under.
Well, Xavier has scored 100 points in their last 80 minutes of basketball. So I And that was on the heels of two games where they had halves of 18 and I think 22. So this is – so the 121, I mean, I don't know how many of those they're expecting X to get if it's a 9-point – if they're 9-point dogs, but it's going to be a – it's going to be a tough go. I guess the one thing that will play in X's favor maybe is that after four straight games in Cincinnati, none of which have gone particularly according to plan. This opportunity to go back on the road may give the team a chance to refocus after, you know, the holidays are over, get a chance to refocus, get a chance to live basketball for a couple days, and hopefully get back on the right track.
Yeah, and the other thing about this Tennessee team, I mean, not that anyone shows up to Thompson Bowling Arena, but they are undefeated there right now, and that is where they beat Wichita State. They've struggled away from home, but from home they are undefeated. And so, you know, Xavier going on the road, who knows what to expect out of this team. But I do think the 9 is pretty generous for Tennessee. I think Xavier's going to struggle, but I think this is going to be another ugly, low-scoring game. And if Xavier is locked in defensively, playing intense basketball like we've seen them do in some of their bigger games, everyone's going to refer back to the Butler game, and that's a great example of it. If they play it that way, they'll be in this game at the end and have a chance to win again. The problem is this team has really struggled in end-of-game situations scoring and winning games. So even if they're in it, it's probably going to be a tough one to pull out on the road, but that's my prediction, is that it's ugly and low-scoring.
Well, UT's home schedule includes Kennesaw State, UNC Asheville. Asheville was at a neutral tournament. Oakland, Wichita, as you say, Presbyterian and Western Carolina. So they haven't exactly played the NBA's Pacific Division.
No, but Wichita State's one of the better teams they played, and they did beat them there. And Xavier,
absolutely,
by the way, hasn't played the strongest competition at home, and they've struggled. So
absolutely, absolutely. So it will be. It is going to be a game tomorrow that pretty much is a toss-up. It's tough for me to believe that Tennessee is favored by more points over the Musketeers than UC was, but, you know, such is basketball, I suppose. Well, Rick, I don't know that we have any more Xavier topics to discuss. Did you get any good presents for Christmas?
Pants, that's about it. Actually, you know, to be honest with you, gift cards are always my favorite. I'm fat ass, so I'd go eat at Cheddar's or something for free, I guess. I don't know. Chris.
Well, actually, yeah, I got some good stuff. I got some new sneakers, and also one of my favorite gifts now that I'm getting old and boring is that my aunt, who lives out in the country and who's retired, always gets us a big basket of sort of jellies and, you know, nuts and all kinds of sort of the sort of thing that I am not qualified to produce myself. So it's always nice. Some, you know, some pickles, some jalapenos out of her garden, that sort of thing. So that just shows you how old and boring I'm getting. I remember when I was a kid, it used to be like a Nintendo or something like that. And now I'm delighted to get a jar of pickles. That's right.
Wow. This podcast has really fallen off in the last few minutes.
As they once said on the We Hate Movies podcast, it's a favorite of mine. I don't know if a podcast can get canceled, but that may have gotten it canceled. Rick, this is number 16. I've been racking my brain about this because I try and come up with a local sports figure that wore that number, and honestly, I can't think of anybody.
It's
the best
be Reggie
I can
Sanders.
Do.
Sanders, come on.
Yeah, Reggie Sanders. Okay,
that's game, Dan.
That's
I'm disappointed.
Right. I had Edgar Renteria.
That might get the podcast canceled. That's enough from you. You're shut down for the night. We appreciate it as always. Thanks for tuning in to the Dana Victory Podcast. This was the 16th Reggie Sanders episode, only on MusketeerReport.com. For Dan, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.